Did you make some arrangement for translation? I'm going to talk in English.
Did you get a question? Hello, I'm not translating in English.
Okay.
Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namane Namaste Sarasate Deve Gauravani Pacharane Vivishesha Shunyavari Paschachade Sakarane Om Gyanam Timarandasya Karanjana Shalakaya Chatsun Virishun Jainam Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Vansa Kalpa Trivyasya Kripa Sindhu Vrevacha Pritama Avane Vrashya. So in this Bhagavad Gita, we find that several places Krishna says that he's going to give two things in Sanskrit, Jnana and Vijnana. The word Jnana means knowledge, and vijnana means experienced or practical knowledge. There's theoretical knowledge, but then we take that knowledge and we apply it in the world to get some result. When it's applied, it's called vijnana. So sometimes in English, Prabhupada calls vijnana realized knowledge. Well, for example, in the very beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, in the second chapter, which is called the contents of the Gita summarized, there's both jnana and vijnana. The jnana part, Krishna calls in the second chapter Sankhya Yoga. The analytical study of the difference between spirit and matter. And then the other part is he calls Buddhi Yoga, where we learn how to act in such a way that this is not just a theory about spiritual and matter, but we experience the truth of this distinction in our lives, because it's an important matter to apply. If there's somebody has a theory but it has no relevance, no bearing on practice, what use is it? So any theory has to result, to be worthwhile, has to have some bearing in practice. And we only know if the theory is true when we apply it. And we see for ourselves that it's true. And when we do that, we call it science. And so Prabhupada refers to this vijnana as science. He says knowledge means information that is given in the Vedas. But it is scientific because the practitioner realizes it by his own experience. So there may be so many claims in the Vedas about things perhaps right now are beyond our experience, such as the idea of the soul or the super soul. If we apply that knowledge in a practical way, we can actually confirm these things by our own experience. This is the claim that Krishna makes in the Bhagavad Gita. In the ninth chapter, for example, he says that what he's teaching Arjuna is the supreme among knowledge, Raja Vidya. It's the monarch, the king of knowledge. And it's the most the greatest of all secrets. He calls it a secret, a guhyam. It's confidential, or as we like to say, esoteric. Not everyone will be able to come to this point of this understanding. But when it is realized, Krishna says, pratyaksha avagamam dharmyam. It gives pratyaksha. In Sanskrit, the word pratyaksha means right in front of your eyes. Aksha means eyes, and prati means before the eyes. So that you see by direct experience. So therefore, it is a science. And when one has this experience, there's some practical consequences. One, Krishna says, you will be relieved of all the miseries of material existence. So it's worthwhile. I mean, for example, that is today the reason why people purchase technology and the products of modern science, because we think it's going to improve our lives somehow or other. And so we're persuaded to support this research and to buy the products and so on, because our lives will supposed to become better. Whether they do or not is another question. According to the Bhagavad Gita, they don't really solve, this kind of science doesn't actually solve the real problems. The real problems are birth, old age, disease, and death. If we are looking to become happy in this world, my first suggestion is solve the death problem. My other advice, if somebody wants to be happy in the material world, is do not get any older than, say, 19. Solve this problem. Because these are the real problems. Now, birth, death, old age, and disease are considered to be the real problem, because no matter how much money we make, how much technology we have, still these things are there. Death will be there. So, all right, you die surrounded by expensive physicians and a lot of high technical equipment, you're still dying. So this is these are the considered the real problems. And because people are not relieved of the miseries of material existence, we have to ask what is wrong. And so this is where the Bhagavad Gita should be of interest to us, because it gives a way of understanding, facing the real problem of life, and also make a solution. So in the beginning, first of all, Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, in the part called Sankhya Yoga, the difference between spirit and matter, or as we should say, between the self and the not-self. Because the Bhagavad Gita presents this idea to us about our real identity, that we are spirit. In the study of the Vedas, all schools of thought agree on certain things. As you may know, The Vedas have developed different schools of transcendentalists, or people who are cultivating spiritual life, and sometimes they go, have different emphasis and go in different directions. But there's one thing that everybody agrees on. There's a few things everybody agrees on. One of the main things is contained in the Upanishads, Aham Brahmasmi. I am Brahman. I am spirit. So, I am spirit, and that also implies that I'm not matter. And if I'm not matter, that also means I am not this body. Because this body is described in the Bhagavad Gita as a yantra, made of maya, a machine made of material energy. So the first proposal is that we have to distinguish who I am, the Atma, or the Self, from the not-self. Now, the material energy is also described to us in the Bhagavad Gita in a rough way as having eight elements. I mean, you can break it down in a finer and finer way, but basically there are eight elements. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, or space. And then there's three more elements. And earth, water, fire, air, and ether, maybe we're also familiar with these terms. They're old-fashioned terms. In the Middle Ages, there was four elements. And then also the quintessence, the fifth element, was sometimes mentioned. This may seem crude to us, by the way, but earth, water, fire, air, ether, but you can make it sound a little more up to date by just saying solids, liquids, gases, radiant energy, and space. These are called the gross elements. Gross means that they are more apparent to our senses. But then the Bhagavad Gita also goes to mention three other material elements. And in Sanskrit they're called manas, buddhi, and ahankara. They're not really very good equivalents for these in English or in German. They're technical terms. But manas, Prabhupada translates into English as mind, buddhi as intelligence, and ahankara as false ego. But they make up what is called the subtle body of the living entity. That our body actually has two layers, you might say, or we are wrapped in two coverings, the gross covering and the subtle covering. And the subtle covering are our own, we can experience in terms of our own psychic activities. The mind is thinking and feeling and willing. Buddhi is described as the faculty of discrimination and fixing the attention, some of the functions of intelligence. And then ahankara, the ego, is just our idea of our self. And it's called false ego because we have the wrong idea. The very foundation of our existence is now being carried on the wrong idea. So these things, these eight things that make up our body, our gross and subtle body, is actually, according to the Bhagavad Gita, the not-self. this body and the gross and subtle elements really belong to the whole system of material nature. But because we are deluded by a false ego, we identify ourselves with the body. So we say, generally, here the skin, this is the boundary, this is the grenze, the border, and here on this side is the self, and on that side is the not-self, is the environment, the where I live. But this is wrong, according to the Bhagavad Gita, that we have to redraw the boundaries correctly. And there's a kind of exercise we can do to get an idea of this. Because the self, what constitutes the self? If I'm not my mind and I'm not my body, what is there left? And the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads identify the symptom of the self, of the Atma, as consciousness. Consciousness means my ability to have experiences, to undergo experiences. Simply that. If you look at this cartel here, you see this is an object made of material nature taking up space. My body is an object made of material nature taking up space. But there's a difference. Here, there's somebody at home. I am undergoing experiences. This cartel doesn't undergo any experiences. This is an object, but I'm not just an object, I'm also a subject. I undergo experiences. I have significance for myself. Whereas this cartel only has significance for others. So here, there is consciousness. I am here. As you say in German, Dasein. This is where I am. So this consciousness, it says, this is actually the symptom of the self. And so, the consciousness is therefore described sometimes as the drasta, the seer, that which sees or is aware. And so, the self is the seer, and here in this world, the not-self is the seen, that which is seen. So here with our conventional idea of our body, what our body is just an organized arrangement of organs of the senses. So of course I see with these eyes, I hear with these ears, touch comes from the skin, and so on. So in this way I identify with the body, and yes, I am the one that's seeing or aware of the world with my senses. So this is the self and this is the not-self. Yet at the same time, we are conscious. Our eyes may be seeing, but we are conscious that our eyes are seeing and our ears are hearing, but we're conscious that our ears are hearing. Our tongue is tasting, we know that our tongue is tasting. So actually, we are also aware of our own body and its machinery, its mechanisms at work. So then we have to say, well, then the body is the scene. I'm aware of my body, I'm conscious of my body. So then now we have to draw the boundary back. The body is now, we understand, it's the not-self. And generally the next place we draw the boundary is, well, we identify with the mind. And we think of the mind, well, I mean, in German the word mind and spirit are pretty much the same word. We think that we identify more closely with our mind. After all, if something goes wrong with my body, if my arm doesn't work anymore and so on, I feel, well, that's a problem, but I still feel like I am myself. I just have this difficult body to deal with. But if there's something goes wrong with our subtle body, there's a malfunction in our mind, then we it seems like it's closer to us. We're more affected by it. So we identify more with our mind. But the same principle applies. Our mind thinks and feels and wills, but we're also aware of our mind working. We watch ourselves think. We can actually think about thinking. We watch our own thinking and our own feeling. Sometimes people have this experience of very strong emotional states. Maybe they have some kind of mental breakdown and they end up lying on the floor screaming or something like that. And the doctors have to come and sedate them and all those other things, give them some drugs. But people who do this report like they are somewhere far away watching themselves fall apart mentally. And as though they're just attached and seeing themselves. So we have this capacity that our own workings of our subtle body, we're also the seer of that. So we have to say that let us draw the boundary back again. And the mind is also the not-self. So actually the gross and the subtle body, we know they're part of the same network of cause and effect, which is also tied in with material nature. What happens to our gross body affects our subtle body. It's a simple thing. If I drink some beer, that will affect my subtle body. My mind will start to act in a different way. So the gross body affects the subtle body. Or if I become angry, that's something that takes place in my subtle body. Also, my face will become red and my blood pressure will increase and so on. So all these two things, they're tied together, interlaced in a way that we don't really understand very well. But our body is this kind of psycho-physical unit. And we have identified with it. And the Vedas say we are not the body, that consciousness is a symptom of the soul. Now, it's interesting to look at ourselves in this way because we should understand that what is our environment is really the body, and the closest part of material nature to us is our own mind. Where do we live? What is our environment? Our environment is our own mind. Is it a nice place? Is it neat and clean? Is it free from pollution? We have all over the world, people are trying to clean up the environment. But actually, where the environment really should begin is cleaning up the mind. We skip this part, we work out there, but if we don't actually work on the real part of the environment that's closest to it, we will never actually be successful. So that's one practical thing. So anyway, the Vedas, this way I'm just trying to give you an idea of this understanding that I'm not the body. But still, even though I may believe this theoretically, nevertheless, I've identified with the material body, and I experience whatever's happening to the body as happening to me. But we need, according to the Bhagavad Gita, if we can free ourselves from this identification of the self with material body, that is called liberated. Because the characteristic of the soul, we've talked about consciousness as the characteristic of the soul, but the soul actually has three attributes that are mentioned in the Vedas: Sat, Chit, Ananda. So Chit is consciousness or awareness. But you notice right now in this world, our consciousness is very dim. It's sometimes it's very dull. Our alertness goes up and down. But if we have certain things that happen to us that increases our consciousness, immediately we feel more alive. And people like that feeling. We delight in feeling more alive and more conscious. That is why certain groups of people get a taste for war. Because when there's danger, they become more alert. And in the presence of that threat of death, their consciousness increases. And they feel alive. That's why other people, they pursue this experience by putting themselves into danger, maybe not war, but they'll climb tall mountains with just their bare fingers and engage in all kinds of dangerous sports and fast cars because it makes them feel more alive. So consciousness itself is what gives us the sense of being really alive. But here, right now, in our own world, somehow or other that consciousness becomes dull to us. But that consciousness, that chit, is an attribute of the soul. Another attribute of the soul is sat. Sat means without beginning or end. Existence, but real existence, not temporary existence. And finally, the other attribute of the soul is ananda, which means bliss, happiness. These things we actually have, sat, chit, and ananda. But when we identify the self mistakenly with the body, now we experience ourselves in the opposite way. Asat, temporary. I have a beginning and an end. Although I want to live, and I want to live as long as I can, still I feel I'm bound by two dates: my date of birth and my date of death. And somewhere in there I have my temporary existence. We want to be conscious and alert and alive, but our consciousness and our knowledge is dim. We need to know what's going on in the world, but we can't figure it out. I don't know what's happening in the next room. Most of us would like to know what the future will bring, but we have no knowledge of that. So we're asat, achit, and nirananda. There's the bliss is not there. We want bliss, we want happiness, we want joy. But it only, whenever it comes and then goes away. And we are dissatisfied with this situation. Because we are actually expecting Sat Chit and Ananda. That's what we want out of light, and it is not coming in this world. So we are in an incompatible situation. The eternal blissful spirit soul is now in a place where everything is temporary. This is our predicament. This is our problem in this material world. And until we deal with this problem, we will not become happy or satisfied. So the Bhagavad Gita is teaching us how to deal with this problem. And now we have to apply. We have some theoretical knowledge that who I am and why am I suffering. This analysis is given in Sankhya, that I'm eternal and in this temporary body. I am unchanging, but the body is changing. Now how do I get myself out of this condition? This is the next part, this Buddhi Yoga, where I now apply my intelligence to acting in such a way that this false ego goes away. And therefore, this part of this discipline by which I can experience myself as a spirit soul involves the practice of control of the senses and control of the mind. I am in the world, I have to act. But I now have to act in such a way that I am not attached to the results of my work. This is Buddhi Yoga. The this discipline of actually uncovering the self involves, among other things, becoming free from the activities of sense gratification. Now, what is wrong with sense gratification? We're here in the world, it's spread before us a banquet of so many things to enjoy, the advertisements on the television and everywhere saying buy this, get this, enjoy this, and take this. And as an American, I know that my civic duty is to consume as much as possible. For that consumption is maintaining the whole world. Should I stop to buy? Should I quit enjoying? Everything will collapse. So this is how we're trained. Keep the economy going by buying as much as possible. I don't have any money, I can't buy. No matter, here's credit. You can borrow. And apparently there's no limit to how much you can borrow. So we are being taught that happiness comes from the satisfaction of the senses. But the Bhagavad Gita, the news in the Bhagavad Gita, and the news in the Vedas, and actually not only does Krishna tell us this, Buddha tells us this, Jesus tells us this, everybody is saying it, that this path of trying to become happy through enjoying the world is a disaster, and we will get just the opposite results. This may be bad news for the economy, but it's good news for humanity. So we can, and there's a very scientific explanation for this. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, in the fifth chapter, he says, Yehi samsparsaja bhoga dukkha yonaya evate. This says quite simply that those pleasures that arise from the contact between the senses and the objects are in fact the cause of all suffering. He uses that word dukkha, the same word that Buddha uses. When he says that material existence is dukkha, it is suffering. So this is what he said, that We bring our senses into contact with the object, samsparasaja. And from that there's bhoga. There's some feeling of pleasure. So naturally we tend to think, oh, I feel this pleasure. So therefore the path of happiness must be just to keep that feeling going and to add to it more and more. The world is designed, we think like that, and that by increasing this pleasure from the contact with the senses, I will become happy. But Krishna is saying, actually, the world is just the opposite. Dukkha, you know, it is the cause of all suffering. And now I think we are in a position to understand why. We are suffering because we are eternal spiritual beings, full of bliss and knowledge, but we've identified ourselves with this body, which is temporary, so on. Now, why do we identify? What causes this identification of the self with the body? This is the activity of sense gratification that does it. You see, if I just think to myself, I'm not the body, I'm a Hare Krishna, right? I believe I'm not the body. This is my, you know, church doctrine, you can say. So I say it officially. That doesn't change the way I experience, just having the right theory. No, I have to put the theory into action. And so this points to the fact that I need to do something to stop this identification of the self with the material body. So every time I try to enjoy in the world, I put my senses in contact with the object and I feel some pleasure, I become attached. My identification with the body becomes greater and my attachment to the material objects becomes deeper. That's the problem with this activity of sense gratification. It actually causes suffering. Now we may think, well, there's no alternative. That may be one thing. Well, okay, I suffer, but I'm going to die anyway. Let me have a few cheap thrills and then get it over with. But there's an alternative. And actually, in the past, before this current overdevelopment of material civilization was here, the wise people knew this. And almost all the tradition, religions, and moralities that we have inherited from the past, in one way or other, give restrictions or regulations of material enjoyment. In the Christianity, you know, you have Judaism, you have the basic Ten Commandments. Don't do this, don't do that, don't do this, don't do that. Thou shalt not. And if you look everywhere, there's some regulation like that. And the people that become very spiritual, they become more and more austere. Look at Jesus. Now, at least in America, people are worshiping Jesus very much and thinking that Jesus wants you to be rich. The preachers say like this, that you worship Jesus and he'll reward you with money. But of course, if you read the Gospels, Jesus says it is as difficult as a rich man to get into heaven as it is for a camel to go through an eye of a needle. He didn't say he wants you, he says you should get rid of everything. That is recent. But somehow or other, in the course of time, it's changed. The Bhagavad Gita calls this Dharma Shiglani, the decline of religion. So we inherit these restrictions from the past, but now we don't know why they're there. Why do these sages and saints from the past Why do they say, don't do this, don't do that? You don't see any reason for it. We think that in the past there were these nasty old men, these patriarchs, with their beards, and they didn't want people to have fun. They look like the Ayatollah Khomeini, you know, their mouth is twisted in disgust. Don't do this, don't do that. These life-denying religions and moralities. And we need to be liberated. And we define liberation as we need to enjoy in this world. But unfortunately, from the past, we have got this guilt. We need to get rid of this guilt. Become free spirits. Then we will be happy. Huh? Unfortunately, it goes just the opposite way. Because the people now, they don't understand what is the reason for these restrictions like that. And that's why we should appreciate the Bhagavad Gita, because everything is explained as part of a science of spiritual life. It is not this religion or that religion, but there are laws of spiritual life, laws of the science of spiritual life. And it says like this, that this is what is necessary, that one should become what is called in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna presents the image of the sthita dhimuni, the sage of the steady mind. I'll just read you a little description. In our lives, we need ideals. What we should be like. And young people today, I don't know what they think is a cultural hero. Usually some horrible rock, pop music star doing who knows what. People who have lots of money and intoxicants and one wife or husband after another and all these things. This is their ideal person. But here's the ideal person from the Bhagavad Gita. I'm going to start reading some texts beginning in the second chapter, page 54. I just want you to appreciate this idea of what we should become. Krishna has been describing this how to live in such a way that we are no longer attached to the material world. And so Arjuna says in text 54, what are the symptoms of one whose consciousness is thus merged in transcendence? How does he speak? What is his language? How does he sit? 254. Arjuna Vacha, Stita Prajna, called Stita Prajna, is one who is fixed in wisdom or intelligence. How does he sit? How does he walk? So when he says, what are his symptoms, it begins to describe like this. The Supreme Personality of Godhead says, O Partha, meaning Arjuna, when a man gives up all varieties of desire for sense gratification, which arise from mental concoction, when his mind, thus purified, finds satisfaction in the self alone, then he is said to be in pure transcendental consciousness. One who is not disturbed in mind, even amidst the threefold miseries, or elated with their happiness, who is free from attachment, fear, and anger, is called a sage of steady mind. See, in our material consciousness, sometimes good things come and bad things come. When good things come, we're overjoyed. When bad things come, we're downcast. So pretty much we're the prisoner of events. Material nature is working out of control. out of our control, and we just get pushed around. Our happiness depends upon the course of material nature. But here he's saying someone who, even when good things happen, he's not elated. When bad things happen, he's not downcast. That's because this person has a source of happiness that comes from the spiritual level. It doesn't depend upon the course of material events. If we have tied our happiness, our future and our hopes to the course of material events, it is going to be bad. In the material world, there are not happy endings. We see the films from Hollywood in these places. There's some drama takes place. The boy meets the girl. There's some obstacle. They're separated. They have to struggle. Then the boy and the girl comes together again. And then they're together and the music comes on, and the sun, they're walking off into the sunrise. And it says the end, and then you think, oh, now they live happily ever after. Keep the cameras rolling. Let us keep filming until we see what happens. The material world, it always ends in a certain way. And we don't like to show that ending. So we have all this very sophisticated cultural machinery to help us stay in illusion, like the entertainment industry. So here, this is another idea, the sage of the steady mind, who's not elated when there's happiness, free from attachment, fear, and anger. Krishna continues, in the material world, one who is unaffected by whatever good or evil he may obtain, neither praising nor despising it, is firmly fixed in person and perfect knowledge. So that's how this person acts in the world. The same person can also, whenever he wants, withdraw from the world. One who is able to withdraw his senses from sense objects, as the tortoise draws its limbs within the shell, is firmly fixed in perfect consciousness. And then he says, the embodied soul may be restricted from sense enjoyment, though the taste for sense objects remains. So here, Krishna is saying you may have an objection. Okay, so I become like this, I pull my senses away from the objects, but the taste will still be in my mind. What about that? And he said, but ceasing such engagements by experiencing a higher taste, he's fixed in consciousness. Because when we do withdraw the senses, we become detached. We are now gaining the capacity for spiritual experiences. This taste that we get for enjoying in the material world destroys our capacity for experiencing on the spiritual level. As we become free from the addictions of material so-called happiness, then we are able to revive our capacity for spiritual experience. Then we live the perfect, delightful situation, no matter what happens in the material world. So in this way, we have this description. In text 61, Krishna makes it clear, if we are not concentrating on the object of the senses in the material world, what are we concentrating on? Krishna says, one who restrains his senses, keeping them under full control, and fixes his consciousness on me, is known as a man of steady intelligence. So this is ultimate. We cannot just withdraw our senses. We have to give our senses a spiritual engagement. And that's the other part of this Buddhi Yoga or Bhakti Yoga, that our mischievous senses have to be given some spiritual engagement. And so therefore, the tongue can be engaged in chanting Hare Krishna, talking about Krishna, eating Krishna prasadam. This is one of the difficult senses, the tongue. And we need to take nourishment to stay alive, that's natural. So it is not that Krishna says don't eat, but you should eat only the food that's offered to me. And otherwise, every bite we take, we get deeper entangled in the material nature. Especially if you eat at McDonald's or someplace. But when we eat Krishna prasadam, every bite takes us closer to Krishna. That same activity that was the cause of our bondage now becomes the cause of our liberation. This is the process of Krishna consciousness. And by engaging in this way, we can actually practically realize one becomes a sthitadi muni. That will solve all our problems. Not only will it solve our personal problem in life, it will solve all our social problems. I mean, people think maybe it'll be a disaster for the economy, but the economy should grow. There's a natural economy. And actually, if people simply control their senses, then we will discover the pollution of the earth will go, that will stop. The disappearance of so many species of life, that will stop. I mean, the whole world order will be restored by this way. So it is the best thing we can not only do for ourselves, but for everyone else also. Well, this is the teaching of the Bhagavad Gita. It is actually the only practical solution for all the problems we have on a personal level, on a social level, on a political level, on an ecological level, economic level, all the problems will be taken care of. Thank you. Maybe if anyone has any questions, comments? Yes.
Thank you very much for your lecture. I have heard two lectures from you where you have been talking about this topic, what we are and what we are not. Uh-huh. And I find it very interesting. And after a certain point, I felt like, oh, great, he's a Buddhist. Because I heard from Buddhist things, yeah, that we are not the body. We can watch the thoughts, we can watch the emotions. Mm, yeah. What we are is actually awareness. Mm-hmm. And this makes very much sense to me. Mm-hmm. But how does this fit with all this, with Krishna actually, with stories about a small cowherd boy killing humans and wearing peacock feather in his hand?
We are Buddhists, and then something.
Yes. But for me it's difficult to get these two
things. Yeah. Because the Buddhist concern is simply with negation. And because Buddha, for certain reasons, he did not accept the authority of the Vedas. So therefore, when he was asked about transcendence, is there a soul, is there a God, he said, I have not come to talk about these things. Because he could not. But what there is beyond the material world, we actually have information by people who have regained the capacity for experience of those things. And ultimately, the Buddhist path is very difficult. That's why very few people actually practice it. People are shocked, you know, when they're sitting on the, I knew somebody who was, said, you know, the Dalai Lama, he was on the plane and he was eating a steak. And I said, oh, I thought you were a Buddhist. He said, well, we Tibetan Buddhists, we eat meat. People actually don't practice so much. The real path by Buddha is a tough one. So to become just detached from matter is difficult. To become attached to Krishna, then automatically detached from matter. So this is the beginning of this understanding. I am not the body, I am a spirit soul. But then there is another life. And that is to say, there's the life of the spirit. But the soul itself, as is also explained in the Bhagavad Gita, has a relationship with the super soul. The super soul, who is Paramatma. And this Paramatma is a kind of a partial representation of Krishna. So there's a whole other spiritual science to explore. And we have guides for exploring this. And we find out what the absolute truth is. According to the Vedas, it has three aspects. One is this the impersonal Brahma Jyoti that's there, which is encountered by Buddhists and so on. There is the Paramatma, or the super soul, that not only am I a soul, but I am in contact with the super soul. And in my body, there's two people, myself, and also the super soul, which is an aspect of Krishna, who is guiding and directing the whole universe and also me. And then beyond super soul, there's Bhagavan, Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of God. So there's a gradual progression from one to the other. So some, maybe every time you come, I've been talking about this particular thing, but I can also talk a lot about Krishna. But they're connected. They're connected. We cannot really understand Krishna or even understand this world as it is until we come into the proper state of existential state where the consciousness is clear. Knowledge, says Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, depends upon sattva, on purity or goodness. And so when we purify our consciousness, then knowledge of Krishna is actually already in the heart. This will gradually become revealed to us. And our happiness in spiritual life is not just from the negation of material miseries, but now we have the capacity for real spiritual feelings. And that spiritual feelings, love for Krishna, will increase without any upper limit. There's no upper limit. No matter how much intensity of feeling there is for Krishna, because there's a reciprocation, it will always increase. That's also there. Okay? Yeah? Anything else? All right, so now we have Arti next, huh? Go on. Okay. Hare Krishna, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Thank you.